This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
So here's where we are circa 2017. Is the lead story today something the President of the United States is said to have done at 3 in the morning, or something the President of the United States did at 11 in the morning? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdo. Wednesday, 8 February. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. So we are going to go with the 3 in the morning story first. A report in the Huffington Post today sourced, I am obliged to note here for the record, to anonymous leaks that says President Trump had called his national security adviser, Michael Flynn, to ask whether a strong dollar or a weak dollar is good for the American economy. Again, forget the circumstances and the leak and the partisan sniping that this story will engender, and focus on the question, because really, it's a good one, especially for a president whose economic agenda is so closely tied to international trade and how the dollar is valued. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us going.
There's something about hearing strong dollar that sort of makes you want to strut around with your head held high. Linda Tizar says it sounds great, but it's not that simple. She teaches economics at the University of Michigan.
The word strong dollar sounds like it should be an easy thing to define, but strong is good for some and not good for others.
If you run a business in the U.S. and import parts from overseas, a strong dollar means you can buy more parts for less money. But if you're an exporter making stuff here and selling it overseas, a strong dollar's bad news. It means your stuff is more expensive and you're going to have more competition. And many American businesses are caught in the middle.
Firms can be on both sides of the equation, both an importer and an exporter, so have a very ambiguous position with respect to the dollar.
President Trump said last month that the strong dollar was, quote, killing us. Barry Bosworth, an economist at the Brookings Institution, says from the president's perspective, it is.
If he really is centered on the idea of job creation, he does not want a strong dollar. If you're a worker, this is bad news. The products that you make are being increased in price in world markets. You're going to face intense competition, and the risk of job loss is quite significant.
But there's not much the president can do to weaken our currency. Meg Lunsager is a public policy fellow at the Wilson Center.
It's hard to have a lasting impact by just trying to talk down the currency when you have all these market forces driving it the other way.
Those forces include a high demand for the dollar, simply because it's seen as the safest bet out there. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Okay, so now the 11 o'clock in the morning story, 10:51 technically, when the following tweet was sent from President Trump's personal account. Quote, my daughter Ivanka has been treated so unfairly by Nordstrom. She is a great person, always pushing me to do the right thing. Terrible. The official POTUS account retweeted that a little while later, and here we are with the President of the United States blasting the actions of an individual company, not about moving jobs to Mexico, but instead complaining about a retailer dropping his daughter's fashion line. Marketplace's Adam Allington takes this story to the next logical line, the one that separates official duties from conflicts of interest.
So here's how it breaks down. Ivanka Trump has a fashion line. During the campaign, an online boycott movement singled out retailers who carry the Trump brand, including Nordstrom. Last week, the company announced it's dropping Ivanka's line for the upcoming season, a decision the retailer claims is due to lack of performance.
Retailing is a cruel and harsh business.
Mark Cohen is the director of retail studies at Columbia Business School. He says Nordstrom's decision was likely not about politics.
At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. If customers don't buy her merchandise, stores don't support her merchandise. It's as simple as that.
But it wasn't as simple as that, according to President Trump, who used the official POTUS Twitter account to criticize Nordstrom, which White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer says is his right.
For someone to take out their concern with his policies on a family member of his is not acceptable, and the president has every right as a father to stand up for them.
So, question, is the president allowed to use his position to confront companies about his daughter's business?
It probably doesn't violate any formal legal rules.
William Bode is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. While Trump's tweets might not be illegal, he says that doesn't mean they're ethical.
The president has a set of norms about conflicts of interest that we sort of traditionally expect the president to adhere to, and this may well run contrary to some of those. They just wouldn't be memorialized in statute.
For that, Congress would have to act. Meanwhile, TJ Maxx and Marshalls have told employees to stop promoting Ivanka Trump's line. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
As long as we're on Twitter and its various uses, here's another one. Really, really vile and horrible harassment and abuse. The company has announced some new policies it's going to roll out to deal with that stuff. And I should say, some more new policies here, because Twitter has been down this road before with limited success. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that one.
Lots of people on Twitter have a story. Here's Bailey Polins.
I was getting ready for class one day and saw a notification pop up, and it was someone saying he wanted to rip my face off and wear it.
Poland, who is getting her graduate degree at the University of Findlay, wrote the book Haters, Harassment, Abuse, and Violence Online. For 18 months, tweets like that polluted her feed and the feeds of her friends.
Well, I've had many friends just stop using the service entirely or never start because they know that that's out there.
Twitter seems to be getting the message. This week's announcement to crack down on abusive content and behavior, like making it harder for banned people to sign up again, is seen by some analysts as the most serious step the company's taken to address harassment. It's a good business move, too, says Wedbush Securities' Michael Pachter, considering the anemic growth in Twitter users, just about 1% a quarter.
The only way that they get a bigger valuation is if they, you know, somehow convince investors that they are a growth company again. And the only way they're going to grow is if they can convince people to use the service.
On its website, the company wrote it promises to continue to roll out changes to make Twitter a more hospitable place. Twitter declined to go on the record for this story. Jacqueline Friedman, the former head of Women Action Media, says if Twitter were serious about the abuse problem, the company would be throwing resources at it.
Silicon Valley has invented a self-driving car. If they wanted to come up with sophisticated ways to combat harassment and abuse, they would.
Friedman says one simple solution is for Twitter to hire more moderators who can police communication. She says that's something that could happen today. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Here's a working theory about presidential tweets and individual companies. Do with it what you will. Traders just don't care anymore. Nordstrom shares up a bit more than 4% today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of stories now about energy and how this country gets it. President Trump promised to bring back, and the Republican Congress is in the process of cutting back regulations on the American coal industry. Given capitalism, though, and the way markets work, it can be hard to tell from a distance how much of a difference Washington can actually make out in the mines. So, Marketplace's Scott Tong spent some time with miners to see what they think.
In the coal fields of western Kentucky, when miners tell their story, it's not so much about digging for coal as excavating the past. Here's mine owner Tony Lanham.
In the Lanham family, it started in 1919. I can't remember a time that it wasn't a coal mine where we stand here today in Davis County, Kentucky.
It's a history of a one-time Kentucky energy superhero that powered railroads and steamships, brought us electricity. And here, Mine Superintendent Greg Wettstein says coal is also about destiny and God.
Coal has been a blessing. It's been a blessing for several communities across this country. It's definitely been put here for us to use efficiently and wisely. I believe that firmly, along with gas and wind and water.
But the gift may not be forever. Coal production in the U.S. has fallen for 8 straight years.
We don't actually think it had ever come back as strong as it was. We just are hoping and praying that it comes back strong enough.
That's a pragmatic view here of holding on as Americans defect to other energy sources. Now, there are optimists who speak of a big comeback, but former Kentucky miner Gary Bentley says that hope is manufactured by politicians and coal executives who fly in from far away.
to talk about fighting the war on coal, bringing coal jobs back, then it also gives these people that false hope, and they're so desperate, it's easy to grab onto that.
Grab on, even as Kentucky coal jobs are at their lowest level in 118 years. This mine, known as Western Kentucky Minerals, is a surface mine rather than underground. And the key here is to find what's called the coal seam, and it's a bit of an energy treasure hunt. Tony Lanham's men drill, look down, find it, and then blast it with dynamite to break it up.
If the Lord asked me and said, where would you want it, I'm going to put it there. It's in a perfect place because we can shoot in it, on top of it, or under it and bust it up.
Now there's coal and then there's coal. The way Lanham talks about differences in quality and purity, it's like he's talking about diamonds.
The deeper you go in this area, the better quality of coal. And that's because of so much pressure, it squeezed it down to all the impurities that's pretty much out of it. That seam of coal right there, the old-timers would love that. Oh, my Lord, they'd have died for that right there.
The best coal goes for $300 a ton. The cheapest, maybe $10.
Now you can really hear that drum turning.
The different coals feed into hoppers that churn the pieces and break them up. Some are washed, some are blended with others, and then it's off to market. That is, if it doesn't rain. See, water makes trucks slip and slide, and it makes mushy coal that doesn't burn.
One of our biggest issues would be the weather. We really enjoy the summertime. We just about get by with murder, so to speak.
But there are bigger problems, starting with regulation. For all the benefits of coal, the government about three decades ago began addressing the costs, the different kinds of pollution from burning coal.
They have come in here and changed the laws. They caused the power plants to add on the equipment to capture the mercury, the chlorine, arsenic.
That's even before carbon dioxide pollution, and those rules haven't even kicked in yet. Another long-term challenge is a competing fuel that's cheaper and cleaner. Natural gas from fracking depresses energy prices.
It's going to control our prices down the road.
Now, there's no guarantee coal will fade. Energy prices are volatile, and an innovation could change everything. Still, Tony Lanham is hedging just in case. He is part owner of a river terminal on the Ohio River, where coal and other commodities are loaded onto river barges. It offsets some of the challenges of coal. Lanham's biggest customer, the local power plant, may shut down in 5 years.
It is a shame because there's been so much money and time spent on this modern-day technology.
So, mine owner Tony Lanham is diversifying into what may be his next act, just in case coal doesn't have one. In Owensboro, Western Kentucky, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
That diversifying that Scott was just talking about, it's happening in spades out here in the West with wind and solar power. And a couple of this country's richest men, Philip Anschutz of Oil and Entertainment Industry Wealth, working on what could become America's biggest wind farm out in Wyoming. Also Warren Buffett of Warren Buffett Wealth, working on the power grid itself out here. It's a story that Sammy Roth has been following in a series for the Desert Sun newspaper. Sammy, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me on.
First thing I need you to do is set the scene for me. Tell me about this ranch out in Wyoming, basically the size, of the city of Los Angeles, right?
It is enormous. You get there and you just cannot believe that this is one property, one ranch owned by this guy, Philip Anschutz, one of the richest people in the United States. And it's mostly empty. They've got some cattle running on it, but it's mostly empty, and it was covered in snow when I was there in December, and it is super windy.
Well, which explains why Anschutz wants to put giant wind turbines up there and then sell basically into the California market is what he's trying to do.
Yeah, that's right. So he happened to own this ranch, and they were looking to sell it about 10 years ago. And then one of the guys who worked for him had this great idea of, hey, you know, this is one of the windiest spots in the continental United States. We could build a pretty big wind farm here. And so they've been working on it for 10 years. They want to build 1,000 turbines, which would be the biggest wind farm by far in the country. And they would like to build a 730-mile power line just dedicated to this project to transmit that electricity to California, which wants it.
California and its 39-whatever-it-is-million people, right?
Yeah, 39 compared to about 500,000 or 600,000 in Wyoming. They just don't have the population there to even use that energy.
Anschutz made his money in part in oil. Wyoming is a big, big oil and gas and coal state. They are not taking fondly, the Wyomingans, to this development, are they?
Well, it's really tricky because on the one hand, so yeah, they are totally dependent on coal and oil and gas, and they have been for a long time. Fossil fuels are like 70% of state revenue. On the flip side, the people in power in Cheyenne, the capital, they see that fossil fuels and coal especially is on the decline. And on the one hand, so they see wind as, hey, this is a, you know, potential new source of revenue for us. They're already the only state in the country to tax wind energy. And now what they want to do is, some lawmakers anyway, want to raise the tax substantially. And so on the one hand, that could be something that, you know, in theory could raise new revenues for them. But on the other hand, there's a fear among some people, especially those in the local areas where these projects would be developed, that what they would actually do if they did that would be to tax the industry out of existence.
Hmm. So here we are, though, talking renewables in a state that's got a history of fossil fuels. We are in a brand new presidential administration that is very heavy on fossil fuels, not so much renewables. How does this all play out? Because as the folks in your articles say, and I will tell you, it's a great series, but they basically say the market is going to decide this.
They do. That's one of the most interesting trends in renewable energy right now that, while in the past it's been something that's been thought of as, you know, policies in states like California or at the federal level are really responsible for the growth of solar and of wind. Increasingly, it's happening because of finances, because they're getting so cheap. I just saw some really excellent maps recently that UT Austin did, where they looked at what is the cheapest source of new electricity generation in every county in the United States. And you look at these maps and you see across the Great Plains, it's mostly wind. In a lot of the West, it's solar. You know, utilities and wealthy investors, people like Philip Anschutz and Warren Buffett, they're making these long-term decisions about what they want to invest in, and they're seeing that solar and wind is really the direction the country is moving in, regardless of policy.
Sammy Roth covers energy and the environment for the Desert Sun out in Palm Springs, California. Sammy, thanks very much.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
Coming up.
I'm just happy to be home, sitting on my couch watching my TV.
Not a bad way to spend the winter. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 35 points today, about a 10%, 20,054. The NASDAQ gained 8 points, a 10% there, 5,682. The S&P 500 down a fraction, we'll call it pretty much steady, 2,294. Did you know Bank of America has opened 3 new branches since January that have ATMs and video conferencing capability, but no live people actually working there? So along with self-driving cars, self-checkout, you now have self-banking. Bank of America today off 1%. CEOs of United Airlines, Delta, and American are going to sit down with President Trump tomorrow at the White House. They're going to have breakfast. American down 0.2% today. United Continental up about 0.5%. Delta down 0.1%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The economy, as we say every now and then, isn't just the markets or the energy grid or Twitter, for that matter. It's individual people trying to get by in the economic day-to-day. So today, in an every now and then segment that we call My Economy, with President Trump's executive order on immigration before the courts, a young man who came to this country with his family in 2008 as a refugee from Zambia. We got him in Moscow, Idaho, where he is studying pre-law.
My name is Patrick Ngalamalume, and I'm planning on law school next semester, specializing in either human rights law, civil rights law, or criminal law. I haven't really figured it out yet. The vetting process for refugees, you know, is a very excruciating process that a lot of people don't really understand, you know. You just don't come here as a refugee, you know. You have to go through this process that is hard at times. You know, my parents never really had the opportunity of being educated. So my parents are custodians at schools in Boise. They do whatever it takes to provide for their families every single day. They're hard workers. So, essentially, I'm the first person that's going to graduate from college in my family. The job aspect of things here has been a lot easier to, you know, have right now compared to 2008 when we were getting here from my parents, and you know, that was a little tougher. I mean, like, coming here has just given us, you know, a plethora of opportunities that we've taken advantage of and never been looked back since then. This is why I have this strong belief that the United States is the land of the free, you know, land of the free, home of the brave, and stuff like that, and the land of opportunity as well, you know. You can accomplish whatever you want here in the United States.
That was Patrick Ngalamalume in Moscow, Idaho. Do us a favor, take a second, tell us your story. You can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Shipping on the Great Lakes comes pretty much to a halt this time of year. The lakes freeze, the locks at Sault Ste. Marie shut down, and crews on the big freighters go home to their families. Not everybody stops working, though. WCPN IdeaStream's Elizabeth Miller explains how people are keeping busy over the winter layoff amid a slowdown in that shipping industry.
It's the end of the workday at Great Lakes Towing, a company that proudly points to its 117-year history and founder, John D. Rockefeller. Three men secured in harnesses weld on the bow of a new tugboat they're building, a boat that will assist ships in emergencies and break ice in the Cleveland Harbor. Great Lakes Towing President Joe Stark.
This tug will actually be named the Tug Cleveland.
All of the older tugs are named after states. So we decided we will name these after our ports.
The company has tugboats stationed from Duluth, Minnesota, all the way to Buffalo, New York, helping clients reach 40 different ports across the Great Lakes. But when the shipping season ends, there's little use for tugs. And Stark says the company changes gears.
Shipyard work is what balances out our annual cycle so that we don't go completely dark here. In the old days, they would shut down and everybody would go to Florida. That doesn't happen anymore.
Great Lakes Towing hires anywhere from 50 to 100 extra employees for the winter to help with repair work. The shipping industry started to see a decline in 2009 due to the recession. It's affected towing, too, so Stark says the company had to diversify, and it hasn't been easy.
It has been a struggle. You really have to constantly keep your nose to the grindstone.
According to the Lake Carriers Association, shipping in the region fell 4.5% last year compared to 2015, and almost 8% below the five-year average. But because of its changed business model, Great Lakes Towing is surviving and expanding with a fleet of new tugboats in addition to repairing clients' ships. Stark says the number of employees can actually double during winter ship repair. That's a little different than what happens to all the ship captains, engineers, and deckhands on board ships sailing the Great Lakes.
Basically, everyone gets laid off. Then it's up to them on what they want to do.
That's John Clemens, regional vice president of the American Maritime Officers Union. It has about 400 members. Clemens works in a shipyard during the winter break, but enjoys his month-long vacations that are part of the 300-day shipping season.
I'm just happy to be home, sitting on my couch, watching my TV, tinkering away at my house, a break from being around the same 20 guys for 60 days.
Some shipping companies offer programs to keep employees busy during the break. During the regular season, the Interlake Steamship Company employs some 200 people to work aboard its 9 ships, hauling coal, iron ore, and limestone across the Great Lakes. But over the winter hiatus, the company's Brendan O'Connor says he'll sometimes hire 20 or more employees to work on ship repair.
There are some that elect to participate in our winter maintenance program, and that could be a shipyard in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, a shipyard up in Superior. It could be a layup dock in Detroit.
But no matter how they spend the winter break, shipping companies, engineers, and deck officers are all looking for a better season in 2017. They hope President Trump's promise to rebuild the nation's roads, bridges, and waterways will provide more job opportunities in the Great Lakes. In Cleveland, I'm Elizabeth Miller for Marketplace.
Elizabeth's story was produced for us by Great Lakes Today. That's a collaboration between WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester. Final note on the way out today, which will follow the format of Shot and Chaser. Here's the shot. Today, the British House of Commons approved Prime Minister Theresa May's plan to get going on Brexit. May has said she wants negotiations on getting out of the European Union to start by the end of March. Here then is the chaser. Goldman Sachs said today it's going to move more jobs out of London, this time from a hedge fund it runs there. Last month, Goldman said it was moving about 1,000 jobs out of London all in. All right, we got to go. All in all, kind of meh today on Wall Street. The Dow off 35 points, about a 10%. The Nasdaq up 8 points, 10% there as well. S&P basically flat. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.